the sound and is now in the possession of the Army.
Okay, well, it seems friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they the exact same spot the whole time. They're out solid, I can say that.
Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Mark Weezer, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular
disc. Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I'd gone.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
Strange day indeed. Most peculiar, mama. Roll!
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello again, and welcome to yet another intriguing edition of the program, which is number 463 in the current series. This mouth continues to not get words sounding quite the way they need to sound, but rumor has it that before the next edition of this program, major steps will be taken to fix it. So thank you for your understanding and for continuing to grab the files and make yourself aware of the strangeness that goes on both on and off this planet. This time, commentator and editorialist Dave Furlott, a British correspondent and publisher of Alien Worlds magazine, Stuart Miller, and UFO researcher and author of a fascinating book, UFOs and Nukes, Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapon Sites, Robert Hastings.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlott.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list entitled Blanchard, Little, and Roswell. And the thread has been ongoing for a very long while now. It was begun by Kevin Randall, a gentleman that I highly respect. And the thread is basically a repost of his blog and addresses some things mentioned in Robert Hastings' book, UFOs and Nukes, Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapons Sites. The information that comes into question is what information was discussed between Robert Little and General Blanchard aboard an aircraft bound for Illinois. Little received some information from the man about events that took place in July of 1947 in Roswell, New Mexico. And according to the author of the book, Little told him in an interview that General Blanchard said that an alien spacecraft and four bodies were recovered from the New Mexico desert in July of 1947. Now, that would be earth-shaking news, provided any of it could be verified and confirmed. However, seeing as how General Blanchard and Mr. Little are both dead, it is impossible to confirm the conversation. And it has generated a lot of discussion on the UFO updates list. The concerning part about all of this is that the discussion centers around who got what files and from where and when concerning Major Jesse Marcel and Dr. Jesse Marcel, Jr. It also calls into question whether people can be believed or not regarding some of the things being claimed. For example, someone actually lays claim that they got medical records in addition to military records about individuals. And the problem with that is that medical records are treated like state secrets, and rightly so. So someone claiming that they were given the medical records of an individual, well, that's highly unlikely at best and an outright lie at worst. The problem with all of this is that it's degenerated into a situation where quite possibly some very valid information comes to light, but with all of the mud being thrown at it, it obscures the overall picture. You see, Roswell is one of those UFO legends that has divided camps. And, well, I'll tell you what. Let me summarize briefly some of the various things being said with Roswell. We can't really even decide how many crash sites there were. We have zero, we have one, we have two, and even three potential places where something actually came down in the New Mexico desert and was recovered by the U.S. Army Air Force in July of 47. And the object itself, well, it's either a weather balloon, a Mogul balloon array, or an alien spaceship. Oh, wait a sec. I almost forgot. We also have a potential Fugo balloon from an experiment with Project Paperclip. The bodies recovered vary from 3 to 4 to 6. And we have either 2 or 1 survivor of the crash. And we also have the bodies and survivors being either extraterrestrial creatures or Japanese prisoners of war or scientists that were detained from World War II. It's all very confusing because you get some very credible ufologists supporting all different versions of the Roswell legend based on interviews and opinion and some very hard research into the entire Roswell incident. Now, I personally believe that there was an alien craft that crashed in the New Mexico desert. And it did get recovered by the U.S. military personnel that were stationed at the Roswell Army Air Force Base. The reason I believe that is because of some of the very simple facts that have never been called into question because they happened and nobody has ever denied that they did. Number one, Colonel Blanchard had Walter Haut issue a press release stating that the U.S. Army Air Force recovered a crashed flying saucer. And unless somebody can prove to me that the late General Blanchard was either a crackpot or had a twisted sense of humor, there must have been a reason for him to give such an order. Number two, Major Jesse Marcel recovered debris from a crashed alien spacecraft and brought it home and showed it to his 8-year-old son, who was suitably impressed and surprised at what he saw. For this not to be a fact would require that we believe that an officer with the rank of major and responsible for military intelligence operations on the base is not capable of telling the difference between metal or neoprene and rubber, and additionally doesn't know the difference between balsa wood and metal. Either that, or obviously Major Jesse Marcel was also a crackpot or also had a twisted sense of humor. And number three, the U.S. Army Air Force and their later form, being that of the U.S. Air Force, have admitted that they lied about what was found in the desert in July of 1947, because a weather balloon quickly becomes a Mogul balloon. Which means that the debris that Major Jesse Marcel posed with for pictures in the office was not actual debris from the crash site. Well, you know, no matter how you cut it, some of those facts are never going to change. And that means that, as I said, I stand by. I believe that an alien spaceship crashed in New Mexico in July of 1947. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Perlant, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Oh, Dave Perlant, the believer.
When it comes to that particular situation, most definitely. The facts are there and they're not in dispute. What comes into dispute is every time something new comes out, somebody tries to throw things at it that are completely irrelevant to what's being discussed, the point in fact. And in this situation, instead of concentrating on the actual reported conversation, what they decide to get into is records and who has gotten what from where and when. Does it really matter that somebody supposedly has the military records of Major Jesse Marcel, and this person has it, the other person couldn't get it? Come on. What is this, high school? Hey, I got this. You couldn't. Ha ha. There was a post today on the list. We're talking almost a month now. Let us focus simply on what is 100% valid fact. And if we focus just on that, that gets us a lot closer to the answer of what really happened there. Nothing else. That will get us there. I don't care if you believe or if you don't believe or if you are 100% a skeptomonger. You cannot dispute that fact.
I think the expression is flogging a deceased equine.
Yes, flogging a deceased equine is a good way to put it.
Talking about flogging dead horses, did you happen to catch the ABC primetime?
Of course.
They had footage from the original shoot for the Jennings special, which they used quite liberally all the way through. I think the tone was set for me right off the top when they were with Art Bell in his home studio in Pahrump, Nevada.
Yes.
He said, well, all somebody's got to do is see a flying saucer or a UFO and they immediately become a ufologist.
Says it all in a nutshell.
Unfortunately, it was more of the same old, you
know? Yeah. It's like I said in one of my takes a long time ago. I don't mind if a blind man is standing in front of a tree and he can't see it. It's physically impossible for him to see it. But when somebody stands in front of that same tree with their eyes closed, complaining that they cannot see the tree, it's like, open your eyes.
Can't see the wood for the trees. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, why bother?
But we also have the situation, too, and we have to recognize the fact that, again, it's become quite evident that our illustrious governments are protecting us, shall we say. And as a result of that protection, sometimes some of those people get involved within our community, and they do tend to toss some stuff around to try and confuse us.
Makes you wonder where they're coming from.
It gets quite crazy and quite frustrating.
Tell me about it. As the moderator, I see the same old stuff coming up. And how many times can you say before posting to the list about something, go read the archive?
I understand. But you got to also understand, too, that we're getting new people probably every day that are just discovering this whole phenomena.
All the more reason to go read the archive.
Oh, yeah. Agreed. But they won't. They get excited. So once they're getting excited, it becomes a situation of, oh, geez, has anybody heard about this thing that crashed in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? I just got a little bit about that. God, you got to look at this.
Yeah, in the 14 years of UFO updates, it hasn't occurred to anyone to discuss it.
No, not at all.
And it couldn't possibly be in the UFO updates archive.
No.
No.
Or the other one is, oh, expert, did you guys?
Yeah, and so it goes. Dave Furlot, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you real soon.
For sure.
Bye, Dave.
Bye-bye.
I love the odd-numbered programs of Strange Days Indeed, because that's when we head across the pond and talk with our British contributing editor, publisher, chief scribe of Alien Worlds magazine. We head across the pond. Stuart Miller joins us. Hello, Stuart.
Hello, Errol. Hello, everybody.
Alien Worlds magazine issue number 4.
Yes.
Very tasty, Stuart. You get better and better.
You're very kind, thank you. Anything in particular or just the general?
The whole general feel of it. I'm pleased to see that you are consistently going both sides of the fence.
Yes, I am. Although not too far on both sides of the fence. I give a balanced perspective, and I don't think I cater for one camp exclusively.
I did say both sides of the fence rather than on the fence.
Yes, indeed. I'm just thinking about how far I go in terms of the, in inverted commas, believers side of things. Let's put it this way. On both sides of the fence, actually, there is certainly an element of editing and there is a line I'm not prepared to cross or feel uncomfortable crossing. Having said that, I'm just thinking that if I had somebody who was a debunker as opposed to a skeptic, I actually don't think I would object to reflecting his views. Having said that, within a context, I'm just wondering if I would actually feature an interview with somebody from ExoPolitics. I don't know if I'd be prepared to go in that direction. I might be. I wouldn't rule it out. I think I'd be more inclined to go with a debunker, not because I'd want to present his views particularly as such, but I think I would just be happier getting into the mindset of somebody who thinks along those lines than perhaps with somebody who is an out-and-out believer without any reservations, so to speak, and who is into the heavy conspiratorial side of things. Inevitably, if you're interested in UFOs, there is a conspiratorial element, and I acknowledge that. But I think some people take it to a point that, I suppose anybody's opinions really are of interest, as long as they are, I'm able to frame them, I think, in an appropriate manner. I think that's really the proviso I would add.
Mm.
There is an enormous amount of plain dishonesty, I think, in ufology these days that passes for, and I'm not thinking of ExoPolitics, who actually, I believe, are actually fundamentally quite an honest bunch of people, just
misguided.
Well, I think Paul Kimball made a very interesting observation in his piece on issue 4 of Alien Worlds when he suggested that there is a very thin line between ExoPolitics and Stan Friedman's philosophy, and I think that's perhaps a bit harsh, but there were one or two very uncomfortable statements that Paul made, which I found rang true, actually. And I do really wonder just how far out on a limb ExoPolitics are from the mainstream of ufology. And in some ways, they are more honest in that they make no bones about it. It's just, this is what we believe. And really, a lot of people disguise a pseudo-scientific approach to ufology with really, they really use that as a cover for the fact that they are essentially believers. Now, I don't criticize that because I think I am as well. But there's definitely a change in me, and I guess it is a pull towards the skeptical side a bit more.
That's probably healthier, not just for you, but for a lot of people.
I'll give you an example. It's something that's actually come up today, and it's an article on UFO Digest by a gentleman called Andrew Russell. It's an article entitled Confusion and Contradictions about the Cardiff UFO sightings, the police helicopter. This case still rumbles on. And he's saying that the police and the Ministry of Defence are all changing their story. For listeners who don't recall the story, some months ago, a police helicopter in Cardiff, or over Cardiff in South Wales, reported chasing a UFO, and they made this claim, they actually used the words UFO. And of course the story had added significance because it was two policemen, and the police are considered to be, quote, trained observers, end quote, and they will have seen most things sat up there in that helicopter. So the fact that it was policemen involved obviously carried extra weight. Some 5 days or so after the event, a rather embarrassed couple revealed that they thought that they were responsible for this sighting and that they had released a Chinese lantern for some reason. There was some weight attached to their testimony as well, because firstly, they were a professional couple, as I recall, and that seemed to carry some weight. And the timings and their report of the direction in which they saw their lantern take off seemed, as I recall, to match the positioning of the police helicopter and where they'd reported seeing this object. And at that point, the story died, and there was an embarrassed sort of silence from the Cardiff police, followed up a few days later, I think I've mentioned this on Strange Days before, of an emergency, a 999, that's what we dial in this country for the emergency services, a 999 call to an operator, reputedly of somebody claiming to have seen a big UFO in the sky, only for the operator to put it out to the nearest patrolling police car, who responded that yes, there was something big up in the sky, and it was the moon. In other words, the caller was made to look very stupid, unidentified the caller, by the way, and think it was a man, and it made ufology or people interested in UFOs look rather silly. It was a remarkable coincidence that this tape was released to the public some days after two policemen in a helicopter over Wales claimed to have seen a UFO. Do you remember me mentioning that?
Yes, I do.
And I thought it was a rather nasty, malicious thing for the police to do, because clearly what had happened was they had accepted the story of this couple on the ground as being the most likely explanation for what they'd observed, felt very stupid themselves, and decided to hit back. Now, Andrew Russell, who's written this article for UFO Digest, covers just about every point in the case that's come up, including the possibility of a Chinese or a wedding lantern. Doesn't mention, though, this couple. His only reference to wedding lanterns is, and he's ably aided and abetted here, apparently by Philip Mantle, is the statement that the crew are experienced and would recognize a Chinese wedding lantern if they saw one. And that's that as regards that part of it, and the rest of it is a hodgepodge of conspiracy, even down to the fact that UFO hunters came over to the UK to film an interview with him, and they were stood outside an RAF base to do an interview in relation to this case. And basically, it was very quiet when they got there. They started filming. Some officers or some RAF personnel came out to see what they were doing. They showed them the permits they had that entitled them to film, and they were accepted, and they went off. And then a few minutes later, suddenly the RAF base was a cacophony of noise, including one person driving a forklift truck up to the perimeter fence where they were filming and climbing off and just leaving the engine running. In other words, interfering with their filming. Well, of course, this is conspiratorial as well, and obviously means that the RAF are trying to cover something up. Possibly the fact that the UFO was over. In other words, I'm criticizing this article. I'm criticizing the philosophy perpetrated in it. And I'm saying that in many ways, it's typical of the sort of dishonesty that you can find in the world of UFOs.
Do we know, in fact, that that interference with their shooting at the RAF base did occur?
Well, he says it did, and I've no particular reason to disbelieve him. It's probably just the RAF not wanting a bunch of people nosing about outside their... what does it say? What does it say if that happened? And I don't doubt that it did. Oh, there it is. I've got the name now. RAF St. Athan. I've never heard of it before, but... And no doubt, you'll probably see that on the appropriate edition of UFO Hunters whenever it's transmitted. But what does it tell us? It certainly doesn't tell us that an extraterrestrial craft was flying over Cardiff in South Wales. It doesn't confirm that fact. The best it can tell us is that, as I said a few moments ago, the RAF don't really care for people nosing around outside their perimeter fence. The fact that he's having trouble or seemingly picking up contradictions in what the MOD are telling him, what the South Wales police are telling him, really doesn't say anything there either. So it doesn't give us what we would all like it to be, and it doesn't even get remotely close to it. And particularly when he, well, I presume deliberately ignores, seems to be able to cover every fact in the story bar one, the one where this couple stepped forward, and the one which would seemingly offer the most reasonable explanation for what happened. But then, you know, it gets about all sorts of other areas here as well. If that's all it was, a Chinese wedding lantern, and if two supposedly expert witnesses misidentified this, then what does it say about expert witnesses? Does that mean that all other UFO sightings where the witnesses have been supposedly trained personnel are now suspect because of this? So it's an uncomfortable fact, so we don't go there.
Have you yourself seen Chinese wedding lanterns either in the sky or on sale on the ground?
I've got, I think, 10 of them sat in this room where I'm talking to you now. I bought them I bought them a while ago with the intention of letting them off just a laugh. I have just been too lazy and idle to get round to it.
What size are these things, Stuart?
They can be quite large. I would think, I've not actually unwrapped them, but I think that when I unwrap them, mine are probably going to be something like about 4 or 5 feet in length.
Are they rectangular?
No, they're circular, made of thin paper in a very thin frame, I think it is. I think it's wood.
Balsa wood?
Probably. And you set them off by, I think there are two means of propulsion. One is where you've got effectively what is a candle, I think. It's a wick with wax on it, which nestles underneath, and you light that, and obviously the hot air from that lifts the thing up. And it tends to burn for maybe 15 minutes, something like that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there some infrared footage of
the object that the Cardiff police saw from their helicopter?
I don't remember that.
It seems to me that there was, and this object was rectangular. You could almost describe it like a box kite.
Well, firstly, it's possible that some Chinese lanterns come in that shape. The ones I've tended to see have been circular. We can get into a whole science here of light refraction and reflection and how images can appear in one shape or form. Regardless of which way you look at this, I just have no confidence in the fact that this is anything even remotely, genuinely anomalous. And I think there is a large dollop of embarrassment on the part of South Wales Police. And I think that probably the other authorities involved, well, the MOD have tended to distance themselves from it. I think the police would rather the whole thing went away. But it is interesting in as much as it does bring into question the weight that we bring to the testimony of expert witnesses. Having myself talked to a number of pilots and indeed police officers over the years, I mean, the one thing that you do realize very quickly is that you're just talking to ordinary human beings who do not have particularly enhanced powers of observation beyond that you can find amongst the general public.
Too much credence is given to those types of witnesses.
Absolutely.
They're not trained observers.
Well, I would think the police are probably given some, certainly in the UK and I'm sure elsewhere as well, are probably given some instruction in observing scenes and how to note details down. But in the end, that person will only be as good as their intellect and their capability allows. And you are going to get some people that are going to be very good at it, and you're going to get a lot of people that aren't. I really don't think there's anything particularly that marks them out from the general public at large.
Well, it's rather like the voice at the beginning of this program who says, oh my God, what's that? Oh, please let it be a plane.
Yes.
Hey, he didn't recognize it as a plane straight away.
Yes, that's a very interesting area for me as well, because I live very close to Manchester Airport. My living accommodation is upside down, quite deliberately. In other words, our bedrooms are downstairs, and our living accommodation is upstairs. And one of the reasons for that is that we are halfway up a hill, and it's a fairly nice view. So the guy that built the house did it deliberately, and we eat upstairs, and we've sort of got a, I wouldn't call it a panoramic view over a valley, but I can see a bit. And I'm next to one of the flight paths into Manchester Airport. Now, particularly at night in the dark, it's very interesting to watch these lights come in and how they change when the plane changes its angle of approach and how the light can at one point be extremely dim. You can see something moving there, but it's not exactly a bright light. And then suddenly you've got these massive lights coming at you for a period of time and then they turn away again. It's fascinating to watch. And you can't see any flashing lights. In other words, the undercarriage lights. You can just see either white lights or sort of an amber sort of light.
I guess the white or amber light tends to blot out the wingtip lights and the tail fin light, which would be red and green and whatever is on the back end.
Yeah, I don't tend to see those. I went away for a week on holiday to, which is France, come back and find there's a full debate ongoing about Roswell, which came on UFO update. No surprise.
As Lemberg said yesterday, it seems like every 5 years we get a resurgence of Roswell.
Well, there's two reactions here. On the one hand, it's, I suppose, a little bit despairing. But on the other hand, it's perfectly understandable because it's fascinating. It is fascinating in the sense that this major event occurred. 50 years, more than 50 years later, we still don't really know what happened. But the reason I bring this up is because I interviewed Kevin Randall just before I went away on holiday. A very interesting man he is.
Yeah.
Very nice man. What a genuinely honest and intelligent individual he is. It was a very broad-ranging conversation, but one of the topics we discussed, and I can't say I agree with everything he thinks, not just about Roswell, but about UFOs in general. One part of the conversation turned to the cover-up. And the really original question about why the cover-up. Because as he himself said in his answer, now in 2008, he's looking at a very different society to the one that existed in 1947. We are now regularly, actively talking about the prospect of extraterrestrial life. Most people would not be shocked if some discovery was made, providing it was a distant discovery, I think would be fair to say. A good example of what I've just said there would be, for example, if a telescope was constructed which was powerful enough to detect the existence of industrial activity in the atmosphere of an extrasolar planet. So, for example, an announcement was made that such and such a planet, which is 30 light years away, there is evidence to us that in the atmosphere of that planet, there is some sort of industrial activity going on the surface of that planet. Now, that would be incredibly exciting. I think most people would be incredibly interested as well, deeply interested, but I hardly think that would be something that would send people into a panic. So if that's where we are philosophically with this, and maybe even an incident a bit closer to home, so to speak, which we could sort of take in our stride. If that's where we are with this, then if Roswell was an extraterrestrial event, well, why keep it secret?
And what conclusion? Oh, we have to subscribe and download the PDF of the next issue of Alien Worlds.
I don't think, in all fairness, that there was anything that Kevin offered, because I qualified the question by saying that it was obviously a speculative question to which only a speculative answer could be given, and Kevin entered into the spirit of that question on that basis, and indeed reminds me during his answer that this is speculation. But I don't think there was anything particularly original in his response, in as much as it's not been said or observed before. The technology was the obvious one. He did make one interesting comparison, but I had not heard before. Maybe he has mentioned it elsewhere. He compares it to going back in time to, say, the time of Merlin with a DVD player and a power pack and giving this thing to Merlin and saying, can you replicate that? Mm. And, of course, we can put a DVD into the DVD player and we can then see pictures and sound. But can you try and understand what somebody like Merlin, or anybody for that matter, mm-hmm. would make of such a device? It would seem literally like magic. Kevin suggests that possibly there are elements of the Roswell event which are at that stage. So let's assume that there was a crash of an extraterrestrial craft and it is laden with technology that we don't understand. Okay, why still not tell us? Why not tell us we've got this craft?
Well, because the Brookings Institution has suggested that it would cause mass panic.
I think the trouble with the Brookings Institute was that they were incredibly dismissive of the whole phenomena. They were concerned because of the time within world history could be a subject that could be used by our enemies, the Soviet Union, to sow paranoia and, you know, other problems in the West. And they and the CIA were much more interested in grabbing the subject and taking it over for their own purposes, which they did. And so really, I don't think we can look to the Brookings Institute with any sense of worth as to what they said. It's rubbish.
Rather like the Condon Committee, isn't it?
I've not read in detail the debate that's taken place on updates relating to that either. But it did undergo a sort of revisionist attitude quite some years ago, I think, when people said, well, yeah, okay, the conclusion was negative and dishonest. But there was a lot of very worthwhile research that went on into that report, and that the report is certainly worth looking at from that perspective. The fact that Condon behaved as he did, or seemingly did, is just inexcusable. But, of course, he delivered what I think we all suspect, what the American Air Force wanted, and the words were barely out of his mouth, so to speak, when you could hear the sound of the thud of the blue book being closed.
Yeah.
And the whole subject wrapped up, and a big sigh of relief, and great, we haven't got to bother with this rubbish anymore. In other words, he gave them what they wanted.
To go back to Merlin and magic, interesting interview with David Cherniak in current-ish of Alien Worlds, where David talks about a society that is millions, if not billions, of years older than us and more advanced, coming to visit us.
Yes. In fact, I can reveal to you now, you've probably forgotten this, but in the last program I mentioned that there was an interview with somebody there. We were talking about abductions.
Then you were mocking me because I couldn't figure out who it was.
I wasn't mocking you, but I was teasing you.
You were teasing me, yeah.
Yes, a little. Well, as you might have gathered, it was David. His perspective I found very interesting on abduction. He'd looked at it intensively, and not only intensively, but over a period of time. And given the fact that he is an intelligent man, had been able to subject it to sort of a fairly intensive process of serious and intelligent consideration. And he started out as a skeptic because he had no particular interest in the subject at that point, and then became very interested in it and was actually taken very seriously by some of the main protagonists in it. Hopkins sent him the transcript of one of his books. Willie Strieber sent him the transcript of Communion.
Yeah.
In other words, when David speaks on this, I feel compelled to listen, because I think, you know, what he had to say was worthwhile. In the end, of course, he's not able to answer the question or to answer the mystery. Interesting. I mean, staying on abductions, but I knew this about Kevin Randall. Just coming back to Kevin Randall, I knew this about him before I spoke to him. But it was very interesting listening to him talk about abductions and indeed about cattle mutilations. Kevin does tend to sweep away a lot of the periphery of ufology. I made the point almost that he does so almost to the point of, this is an exaggeration, but almost to the point of leaving Roswell standing alone there on a plinth, so to speak. I mean, that's not true. He is interested, for example, in some crashes. I came across an interesting piece just a couple of days ago, which was entitled Why Space Aliens Picked the Hills. And the hills being Betty and Barney. In other words, why did the space aliens pick on them? And it starts out, this article, it's one of those articles with a real kick in it. It starts out as a sort of a semi-superficial review of their case. It doesn't go into too much detail because the author acknowledges that you can go and find the information elsewhere. But he does potter along a bit with it and then comes to the point of why them. The logic was that the hills were driving a 57 Chevy. And this is a very valuable and attractive car. And that is the reason why the aliens picked on Betty and Barney Hill. And I have to say that when I read that, I did laugh.
Yeah, well, it's rather like Aliens Ate My Buick, isn't it?
Well, indeed, yes.
Thomas Dolby. Yes. She blinded me with science.
There are one or two people out there, actually, writing, I've never been able to figure out who this person is. Couldn't even tell you the name of the website, but they constantly seem to come up with not profound articles on ufology, but interesting ones, and very, very often with a trace of what I call intelligent humour. Oh, yes, that's it. I think it's called 109 or IO9. They've got a very distinctive website, and I've had a lot of amusement and pleasure from them for a couple of months now. They tend to send the thing up, but from the point of view of being inside it as opposed to being outside of it. It is quite funny.
Well, Stuart Miller, we apparently have come to the end of our time together again. How goes the plan to PDF Alien Worlds Mag?
It has been appallingly slow, unnecessarily slow, and just a lack of communication between me and my webmaster. We're nearly there with it, but really this is something that should have happened weeks ago, and I feel very irritated and angry about it.
As I imagine do listeners who would love to subscribe to it online.
Well, I hope people will bear with me and just be a little bit more patient. We are very nearly there with it, but for something really that is fairly straightforward.
The back issues will be there, huh?
Yes, they will.
Oh,
they
good.
Will.
Yeah, because they deserve to be severely read. Stuart, thank you, sir. Always good, and as always, look forward to the next time.
Thank you.
When I trust, my mouth will be functioning way better than it has been of late. And to you, sir. Robert Hastings has been involved with the UFO phenomenon ever since as a military brat. He was privy to an incident in a control center at an Air Force base. His research in the past years has led to the publishing of a new book, UFOs and Nukes, Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapon Sites. And we'll cover some of that, too, in the next while. Robert was last on SDI when it was a radio broadcast. In fact, it was back on July 22, 2006, in program 402, which you can download and listen to as well. Joining us on the line from his home in New Mexico is researcher, author Robert Hastings. Welcome back, Robert.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
You have been an extremely busy man of late. You have been popping up all over the web, all over the internet, on various email lists, blogs, and television, and specifically the Larry King Live program.
Yes, I published my book in early July, and I'm trying to promote it. I think the information contained in it is extremely important. I have been researching the subject of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites for the last 35 years. I've interviewed nearly 100 former and retired Air Force personnel who were involved in incidents where UFOs were around nuclear missile sites, nuclear bomb storage depots, and so forth. What these gentlemen have to say is of enormous importance, in my opinion, and I'm trying my very best to spread the word. I think this is something that people all over the planet need to know about. Some extraordinary things have taken place and have been largely kept from public view.
There have been a few reports, even a book, Faded Giants, and I was also thinking of Terry Hansen and
yes.
The Missing Times.
Exactly. I have strongly promoted Terry's book in my own book because I think it's a must-read, in my opinion. He's a journalist. He goes into great length as to how not only the U.S. media, but media around the world, the major players, have been able to help the government, in effect, knowingly or unknowingly, I suggest a bit of both, suppress the truth about UFOs. And I know almost everyone has heard of Roswell. Almost everyone has heard something about alien abductions. But until very recently, I found when I speak on the college lecture circuit, relatively few people are aware of UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites. To my mind, it's an integral part of what's been going on since World War II, and I think the time has come for that particular aspect of the UFO phenomenon to take center stage.
You mentioned speaking at colleges. Have you had much in the way of heckling at those talks?
I've spoken at over 500 schools in the U.S. since 1981, and my average audience is about 300 people. I simply lay out my case. I present documents. I present the verbatim testimony of these retired military people. So it's a very nuts and bolts, highly documented presentation. And when I speculate, I say I'm speculating, but I speculate very little in the course of the program. Needless to say, in any given audience of 300 people, you're going to have some skeptics. Not heckling per se, but I have people, especially scientific faculty, physicists, astronomers, psychologists, stand up after the program and make one inaccurate statement after another about UFOs and why basically everything I've just said can't be true. Now, with all due respect to these persons' expertise in their own field, they don't know anything about UFOs. They have preconceived notions about what the phenomenon is and is not. I turn the tables and ask them a series of questions, and it becomes quite clear to not only themselves but the entire audience that they're just blowing smoke, and most of the time they sit down and with an embarrassed expression on their face. So that's the way that usually goes.
Those talks that you have given over the years, have they been mostly about UFOs and nukes?
Yes. The primary theme in my program is the nuclear weapons connection. That is what I've devoted my research to. That is what I am most knowledgeable about. I do try to put it in context in terms of what has bubbled to the surface, so to speak, over the last 60 years, reports of UFOs, the fact that you have to separate the signal from the noise. There are lots of misidentified aerial objects. There are some psychological phenomena going on, social mass suggestion kind of phenomenon going on, and you have to address that if you're honest with the data. But as I say to people, when you sweep all of that aside, you're left with a core phenomenon that simply defies conventional explanation.
We've had Robert Salas on this program, and also Professor Bob Jacobs, who was at Big Sur and was running the film unit there when they were firing test missiles out over the Pacific. And you listen to them talk, along with Terry Hansen and yourself, in the way that you've been putting out the information, and you have to say there is something pretty damn strange has been happening at these various missile bases, missile silos in the northern United States.
The principal theme in my book is that UFOs, whoever has been piloting them, has been monitoring our nuclear weapons sites for six decades, and on occasion have been tampering with those nuclear weapons. Probably a number of your listeners would know that there are cases from Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, in March of 1967, when on two separate dates, an entire flight, as it's called, of 10 Minuteman missiles were shut down, just as UFOs were reported in the vicinity of the missiles. First, what I have demonstrated in my book is that even though that's the most publicized case of that type, that's certainly not unique, and I have identified similar incidents at five Air Force bases over the course of the Cold War where the same types of incidents apparently occurred. So this is an ongoing situation. It's far more widespread than the average person is aware. And I think the best explanation for the available data is that we have at least one race from someplace else with vastly superior technology. For whatever reason, whether it's in their own interests or in our interests or a combination of the two, they have been closely scrutinizing the nuclear standoff during the Cold War and have periodically stepped in a semi-covert fashion, demonstrated their displeasure, their ability to interfere with our nuclear weapon systems. I think that's quite evident if you look at the testimony of the persons who were directly involved in these cases. So that's my opinion of what's been going on. Of the persons I've interviewed, the retired Air Force personnel, former Air Force personnel, 75% of them, three-quarters of them, essentially agree with my contention as to what's involved.
Stanton T. Friedman has suggested in the past that the reason for what was going on at Roswell in 1947 was because of the nuclear testing that was going on nearby, and they they were interested in observing and watching what was happening with the development of nuclear weapons on this planet.
I've agreed with that contention for many, many years. Not only Roswell, which was the home of the only atomic bomber base at the time of the alleged crash, I do believe that indeed there was an alien spacecraft that did go down. I, in fact, mention in my book that I've interviewed a man named Chet Lytle, who was involved in the Manhattan Project, which created the atomic bomb during World War II. He subsequently did a great deal of classified work for a number of branches of the U.S. government, the CIA, the Department of Defense, Department of Energy. He was very high with the Atomic Energy Commission at one point in the 50s. In the course of interviewing him about UFO activity involving nuclear weapons, he just out of the blue told me that he was personal friends of Colonel Blanchard, who was the base commander at Roswell Army Airfield, but later on in the 50s when Colonel Blanchard was a general. And long story short, as I describe in the book, Chet Lytle states point blank that at one point Blanchard told him that the object recovered near Roswell was indeed an alien spacecraft and that four bodies were retrieved from it. Chet goes on to say that while he was working with atomic weapons later in the 50s, he was also given indirect information about facilities at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base where the wreckage and the bodies were, in fact, being kept. What I stress to people is this is obviously anecdotal information, as is virtually everything else relating to Roswell, but the source of the information, this gentleman's credentials and his background, are just highly impressive. So you've got another credible source addressing what he contends to be an extraterrestrial origin for the craft at Roswell. I will further mention that up here in Albuquerque, where I live, Sandia Base, which was one of the satellite bases set up by Los Alamos during World War II to engineer nuclear weapons, atomic weapons at that point, I have a whole chapter in my book devoted to UFO activity at Sandia Base, where it was quite clear that whoever were piloting these craft were closely scrutinizing what was going on here at Sandia and up at Los Alamos. And out at the Nevada test site in the 1950s where we were conducting atmospheric atomic tests, the strength of the data, the sources are so great, there are even documents addressing a lot of this activity. It only reinforces the fact that the nuclear weapons link has been going on since World War II.
And Sandia became Sandia National Labs.
That's correct.
where apparently some, and we're leaping around a little here, Robert, but some of the original founding members of the so-called Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, now known as CSI, and what an original name that is. It hooks in nicely with tissue television. Oberg and a couple of other people were out of there as well, yes?
Yeah, we should get to that at this point, I suppose. In the context of the Big Sur case, for your listeners who are not familiar with it, I have a 24-page article at my website on Big Sur. But in essence, in 1964, during one of the missile tests at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, the tests were being filmed, as you noted earlier, by a photographic team the Air Force had set up at Big Sur on the California coast. Bob Jacobs was the head of the photographic team filming those tests, and in the early 80s, Bob Jacobs came forward and publicly said that in September of 64, during one of these test flights of a dummy nuclear warhead system, after the warhead had separated from the rocket booster and was flying downrange, it subsequently developed that on the film was captured a UFO, a disc-shaped object with a dome that came in out of camera frame, circled the dummy warhead, and flashed or fired four beams of light of some type at it, whereupon the missile warhead began to tumble and fell into the Pacific Ocean hundreds of miles short of its target. Now, that story has been entirely endorsed down to the smallest detail by another retired Air Force officer, Major Florenz Mansman, who was the photographic interpretation officer at Vandenberg at the time. He was the one who actually used a magnifier and other types of analysis to look at the image on the film, and states point blank in his statements, both private and public, that this was a disc-shaped object with a dome, a classic UFO that did all this. Bob Jacobs, in 1989, summarized all this information and story in the MUFON UFO Journal, basically reiterating what had taken place and so on. And then later on, a man named Kingston George, who was also a member of the photographic team, part of that project, came forward and said, no, Bob Jacobs is making, quote, weird claims. He doesn't know what he's talking about. There was no UFO involved, and so on. And that story was published in Skeptical Inquirer. Now, what I myself found out, and it's very difficult to find if you look for information on the web until I started putting it out there, the editor, longtime editor of Skeptical Inquirer, is a man named Kendrick Frazier, who gladly published Kingston George's story trying to debunk the UFO incident at Big Sur and all of this. Well, at the time this was going on, unbeknownst to Skeptical Inquirer's readers, most of them, because I've encountered many of them over the years, they had no idea what Kendrick Frazier did for a living. I found out he was working as a public relations specialist for Sandia National Laboratories. So the situation is this: in what is probably the most spectacular nuclear weapons-related UFO case ever revealed, in effect the shooting down of a dummy nuclear warhead in flight, the person who attempted to debunk that story was a public relations specialist working for the U.S. government's nuclear weapon program. And even today, that's not widely known. So I find that coincidence rather interesting.
For the listener, Bob Jacobs' voice is part of the opening of this program as he describes what he saw on the film that was developed after that test missile launch was downed by a UFO.
I have been digging into this case on and off for 20 years. I first spoke with Jacobs in the late 80s. He provided me with correspondence from the early 80s where he and retired Major Mansman were writing back and forth. Major Mansman also was answering questions about this case to other individuals. And I have a small cross-section of that correspondence from the early 80s. And it's quite clear that at the time, both Jacobs and Mansman were still stunned by what had taken place 20 years earlier and were marveling over the fact that that had actually happened and been captured on film. Those letters were never designed to be made public. They were simply insiders, retired Air Force personnel, discussing the case in just a one-on-one basis. Obviously, I used that data to document my case that this indeed was a bona fide UFO incident. So it's now available at the Center for UFO Studies. Researchers can ask and get copies of that correspondence, or at least it's available. I can't speak for the center's time and their efforts to respond to everyone who wants copies of the original correspondence. But it's there for people to go and look at. And again, I think that only reinforces the fact that this is a legitimate case. It has provenance. People were talking about it in private 20 years after it happened, and yet another 20 years before it was widely published, or 10 years before it was widely published, certainly. So it's real, it's legit, and the people who are trying to debunk it, I know the one faction involving PsyCop / CSI, I'm pretty sure I know their motivation. There are other researchers who doubt the merits of the case. Brad Sparks and Joel Carpenter are about to publish an article in International UFO Reporter questioning my findings, questioning the data. I don't know what their arguments are yet, but I've been provided opportunity to respond. I'm quite confident this is a bona fide case.
Oh, I have no doubt in my mind that it was, too.
I should quickly add that Major Mansman died in 2000, and as I was preparing my article on the Big Sur case, I interviewed his widow, who is Vietnamese-American, and she speaks very little English, and it was difficult communicating with her. However, she did say to me that her husband had revealed only a small part of what he knew about the case and what he was involved in. He felt that he had to come forward and support Dr. Jacobs, who was taking lots of criticism, people questioning his honesty and so forth, but she told me that there was much more that Major Mansman could have said about the case, but he felt that he really shouldn't.
It's too bad that there weren't more papers of his found where he may have documented everything.
I raised that point with Dr. Jacobs several years ago, and he told me that shortly after Major Mansman's death, he himself contacted his widow to see whether or not there might be some paperwork relating to the case that could be now made public since he had passed away, and apparently, according to his widow, there really wasn't.
He'd pretty much adhered to being told to shut up about the case.
More than one place in the correspondence that I have, the paperwork that I possess, he said, I never would have talked about this if Jacobs hadn't. At one point, he referred to it as Jacobs opening Pandora's box. And another place, he lamented the fact that Jacobs had gone public because he was afraid that the information about the case would fall into the wrong hands. He then goes on to talk about the Soviets' infiltration of the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos. So he apparently was afraid in these letters from the early 80s that the Soviets would somehow benefit from the information that was leaked or released by Dr. Jacobs. So he was far from being ready to go forward and talk about this.
Did they experience the same sort of thing that Robert Salas had experienced at Malmstrom?
Speaking from my own knowledge of the situation, let me put it in context and say that of all the retired military people that I've talked to who've talked about weapons being impacted, their functionality, their alert status, their readiness to be launched, all of my sources, with the exception of one individual, have said that after the UFO appeared near the nuclear missiles, they, in effect, malfunctioned one way or the other to prevent them from being launched. The issues that were induced would have prevented them from being launched. However, one of my sources, who is a retired Minuteman launch officer, former Minuteman launch officer named David Schur, has told me that one night when he was in the underground launch capsule at Minot Air Force Base in the mid-60s, they got a report down in the capsule from the guard topside saying that a UFO was moving from missile to missile. A bright object was hovering over a given missile site within his flight of 10 missiles. And then very quickly, almost instantaneously, racing at high speed to the next missile site, hovering briefly over it, and so on, down through most of his 10 missiles. David Schur says that meanwhile, down in the capsule, as the UFO moved from missile to missile, they saw what he called spurious indicators, anomalies in the missile's readiness status displayed on their missile readiness panel. And at one point, David Schur said that the launch in progress indicator, the light, was illuminated for each of these missiles where the UFO was, indicating that the missile was preparing to launch. Schur told me that he and his commander had to quickly press the inhibit button to override the launch order, but he said that based on their training and what the indicators were saying, these missiles were preparing to launch briefly. Now, there is a virtually identical incident from the Soviet Union. in October of 82, where retired Soviet Army officers have said that a similar incident occurred at one of their ICBM bases. A UFO was sighted at high altitude, circling the missile base, and at one point during this incident, at least one of the launch capsules, an unspecified number of missiles, were temporarily activated for launch for 15 seconds. That story came to light in 1994 when ABC TV here in the United States sent a reporter named David Ensor to the former Soviet Union to interview former and retired Soviet Army personnel regarding UFO incidents of one kind or another. This was just 3 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and a lot of the hush-hush things were sort of bubbling to light. A number of Western journalists and reporters were actually able to talk to people in the know and get a sense of how the Soviets viewed UFOs. But reporter David Ensor from ABC was told point blank that this, in fact, had taken place in the Soviet Ukraine. I believe it was October 4th, but certainly in October of 1982 that this incident took place. So that, in essence, mirrors what David Shure told me took place at Minot Air Force Base many years earlier in the mid-60s. Now, my personal opinion is that whoever was in the UFOs was not attempting to launch the nuclear missiles. David Shure himself told me that because they were getting a number of spurious indicators, as he called them, it's unclear. In other words, a number of other malfunctions were being indicated by the readiness panel that they had down in the capsule. He's not sure that the launch could have actually taken place. I suspect that no launch of these missiles ever would have taken place either here or the Soviet Union / Russia. That's my opinion, but I don't think that those aboard the UFOs are attempting to start a nuclear war. I just think they're trying to scare the hell out of the people, both in Washington and Moscow, who seem to be intent on maintaining nuclear arsenals of one level or another.
Yeah, it does certainly seem that way, doesn't it? And still in the Soviet Union, in the Ukraine, when Chernobyl had its meltdown, I've been hearing stories over the years that there was a UFO sighted over that plant. Have you heard anything about that, Rob?
Yes, I actually make brief mention of it in one of the appendices in my book. All I know, and I certainly can't vouch for this, but Pravda, one of the leading Soviet newspapers in the Soviet era and still today in Russia, some years ago, I don't have it on the top of my head, but an article was published in Pravda indicating that some radiation monitors, technicians at the site immediately after the explosion, who were sent there to monitor radiation levels, they've come forward and stated to the reporters at Pravda that they saw a sphere, they said it was brass-colored, reddish-brass, luminous sphere hovering above the nuclear reactor. Long story short, apparently a beam of light came down from this object, and then it left. At some point, they had measured the radiation levels prior to this object's appearance, and then they measured them again after the object left. And the story printed in Pravda said that the radiation level had gone down significantly. As I recall, it was about a third as high as it was previously. That also has been published in a Ukrainian magazine. I don't know, again, I can't vouch for that story, but that's what's been circulating.
You have to wonder why they only knocked it down by a third and didn't take it all the way down and avoid a massive loss of life that happened at Chernobyl.
It did. It was. In fact, there will be cancers for many years to come from not only the Ukraine region, but even in Europe. The plume drifted over much of Eastern Europe and up into the Scandinavian countries, as I recall. And so lots of people are going to be continuing to pay the price for that fiasco.
Coming back across the Atlantic, nuclear power stations, there seems to be, for instance, outside of Toronto, fair amount of activity around the Pickering nuclear power plant. Not as much now as they used to be, but there were consistently reports of UFOs being sighted over the nuclear power plant there.
That does not surprise me. I was unaware of that, but in the same appendix where I mentioned the Chernobyl incident, I mentioned six or seven other incidents, sightings at nuclear power plants outside of Phoenix and in upstate New York, in Virginia, where, again, there seems to be intermittent but ongoing UFO activity at these nuclear commercial power plants. I also find interesting the fact that the highly publicized cases from Stephenville, Texas, in January of this year, Lots of the published material has linked the activity to its proximity to the Bush's Western White House, President Bush's ranch, not too far away. What is also factually true, but seems to have been overlooked, is that there's something called the Comanche Peak Nuclear Power Plant in a small town just, I think, 8 miles east of Stephenville, where a lot of the UFO activity was taking place. In fact, there are now sighting reports from residents of that town. I believe it's called Glen Rose. I don't have the data right in front of me, but in any case, there are persons who sighted objects close to that power plant in the days prior to the highly publicized sightings, I think on January 8th. So there is at least one tenuous link between the site, the power plant, and at least one UFO in the days prior to the highly publicized activity.
And let's hop back to Sandia Labs. Do you think that they have known all along about, well, they must have done. There were a lot of reports that came out of there. Was that gathered via Freedom of Information Act?
Largely. In the chapter that I have devoted to the activity at Sandia Labs in the 1950s, there was so much UFO activity, a lot of it in broad daylight, that the Albuquerque Journal and the other paper at the time, the Tribune, were publishing stories on a semi-regular basis of sighting reports of UFOs around Albuquerque in general, but down near Kirtland Air Force Base, which is next to Sandia, what would have been Sandia Base at the time. So it was common knowledge and in the public domain that UFOs seemed to be flying around this area. But yes, a lot of other information has come forward through the Freedom of Information Act. In fact, Brad Sparks, if I'm not mistaken, had actually gotten some of those documents released. It was information basically gathered by OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, at Kirtland Air Force Base, who had jurisdiction over investigating activity at the Sandia Labs right down the road. And so a lot of the reports of not only flying saucers, as they were being called back then, but green fireballs, the ongoing green fireball phenomenon. There was lots of those sighted around Albuquerque during the period of nuclear testing. In fact, I've shared information and have worked with a researcher named Dan Wilson, who has just greatly contributed to ufology's knowledge of the green fireball phenomenon. I have an entire chapter in my book devoted to green fireballs that were sighted almost after every major atomic test in Nevada, where following these detonations, the radioactive debris would drift downwind, sometimes across the entire United States, sometimes in very specific areas in the Southwest. And Dan Wilson has found case after case after case where green fireballs were sighted in the area where the radioactive plume was immediately after these detonations, and largely based on local media reports, newspaper reports, that occurred in these states where the plume was drifting over. And he has, in my mind, fairly conclusively established a link between the appearance of these green fireballs in conjunction with these radioactive debris plumes. I find that quite fascinating. I didn't know anything about that until I began communicating with him a few years ago, but the data that I presented in my book, largely provided by Dan Wilson, is quite impressive in my opinion.
Green fireballs apparently intelligently controlled?
Yes. Some of the pilots who were flying commercial aircraft who sighted these things said that they were actually performed maneuvers. They were flying downward and then suddenly leveled off and flew parallel with their planes. So clearly these were not astronomical phenomena. So yes, the inference is that they were under intelligent control or remote control. In fact, a book from the 1950s written by the first chief of Project Blue Book, Captain Edward Ruppelt, when I began digging into the green fireball phenomenon, I found that he had mentioned that he was at Los Alamos. I forget the exact year, it's in my book, where he was sitting and talking to some of the scientists at Los Alamos about these reports of green fireballs, and Ruppelt said he was surprised to learn that a number of the scientists that he talked with there and technicians expressed the opinion that these green fireballs, in fact, were extraterrestrial probes. They were speculating that there was a spaceship up in orbit, and whoever was in the spaceship was firing these green fireballs down into the atmosphere as probes of one kind or another. Now, that's pretty interesting thinking from top-level or high-level nuclear scientists. And what I say in my book is, I think they were on the right track, but based on what Dan Wilson has uncovered, it seems to me that the activities that those scientists were engaged in themselves probably precipitated the green fireball, something they would not have probably thought about or even imagined as being possible back then.
Were these green fireballs of a uniform size?
I don't know that I can answer that question one way or the other. Any object at a distance, of course, whatever its actual size, its relative size depends on its distance. So I don't know that that's an answerable question.
You were interviewed by a reporter for the Albuquerque newspaper there.
I was.
And apparently the reporter mangled the story.
Well, he basically took word for word what Kendrick Frazier told him about the Big Sur case and what James Obert said about the Big Sur case and just swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. At my website, ufohastings.com, I have articles not only on my research into Big Sur, but also an article titled Reporter Duped by UFO Debunkers. And I describe that incident back in August, not even a month ago, where I was interviewed by the Albuquerque Journal. I presented declassified documents linking UFOs with nuclear weapons sites. I presented the reporter with verbatim testimony from a number of my ex-military personnel. I even gave him a copy of my book, which, again, presents the testimony of dozens and dozens of persons involved with nuclear weapons talking about UFO activity that they personally witnessed. Well, he chose to ignore all that and subsequently interviewed Kendrick Frazier. Frazier, of course, said Big Sur was nonsense. He told him to contact Kingston George. Kingston George, who was working with Bob Jacobs on the telescope project, said, no, Jacobs has got it all wrong, weird claims, nothing there, no UFOs. And also James Obert was interviewed, apparently, again, because Kendrick Frazier told the reporter to talk to Jim Obert. In any case, Obert said, nah, there's no link between UFOs and nuclear weapons. Hastings has it wrong. Well, I wrote a scathing rebuttal to all of that, which, again, is in this article at my website, ufohastings.com. In the larger article on Big Sur that I published in 2006, I went through Kingston George's article published in Skeptical Inquirer on the Big Sur case and found error after error where he had just blatantly misquoted Jacobs and made Jacobs look like an idiot. And if you compare what Jacobs wrote in his MUFON article from, I think, January of 1989, and if you compare it with what Kingston George said Jacobs said with what Jacobs actually said, you'll see that it was badly mangled. Now, I have confronted Kingston George with that, and even to this day, he has not addressed the fact that he made just factual error after factual error. I have no way of knowing or proving that he was attempting to disseminate disinformation with Kendrick Frazier and Skeptical Inquirer, but that's my opinion of what was taking place. Neither of those guys have honestly addressed the fact that much of the information in Kingston George's article was factually inaccurate and flawed and presented a very skewed case for what Jacob supposedly said. And if they're not going to honestly address those errors even today, then I'm just going to suggest that they were knowingly perpetrating those errors for the purposes of disinformation. That's my opinion.
And it certainly looks like that, doesn't it?
Well, you'll never prove it unless someone, you know, is put under oath in a court of law where lies become perjury and get some of these people on the record as to what they've been up to over the years, what their affiliations might mean, and so on and so forth. You know, they're going to deny everything until the bitter end, of course.
We had James Oberg on the UFO updates list for a few years ago, and many, many, many of his explanations about all kinds of UFO cases were just so fatuous and ridiculous. And none of us have ever been able to figure out why the hell he's been doing what he's doing when he's obviously a bright, intelligent man and all he has to do is look at the evidence that's available and there can be no denying that something very strange is going on.
Well, a couple of things. In Bob Jacobs' MUFON UFO Journal article from 1989, I would urge all of your listeners to go back and read that word for word. Jacobs mentions the fact that after he broke the story about the UFO shooting down the dummy nuclear warhead, James Obert wrote him a letter just chastising him severely for releasing, quote, top secret information, If you read word for word what Oberg said to Jacobs, it's clear that Oberg put stock in and believed the fact that some very legitimate top secret information was being leaked. Now, given that James Oberg's public stance as a debunker is that UFOs don't even exist and are just figments of people's imagination or misidentified crashing space probes or whatever, that's his big thing. All the satellites crashing down are what people call UFOs. But in any case, you have to compare and wonder why in this private letter, which Oberg presumably suspected never would have seen the light of day, he didn't know that Jacobs was going to push back and publicize all this information. You've got Oberg chastising him for releasing classified information on the case where he should have been, you know, if he was a true debunker, probably should have been saying to Jacobs, how can you believe this silliness? It's just nonsense. It's a myth and so on. But that's not what he's doing in this private letter to Jacobs. So I find that very interesting. I also find interesting the fact that in the early 70s, for 2 years, James Oberg worked at a facility here at Kirtland Air Force Base on nuclear weapons development. He was specifically involved in computer code, computer-related aspects to nuclear weapons and laser weapons modeling. At the same time, he was serving as security officer for the particular group that he worked with, meaning that his responsibility was to monitor procedures that would ensure the security of the information involved. So that's part of his background before he went to NASA. And to my mind, what he's doing with Jacobs in this letter is acting in the role of a security officer, saying, how dare you release this information to the public? And yet that's not the public face that people see of James Oberg. You see the skeptic saying that UFOs are nonsense. So something doesn't quite add up there.
Well, it's good that that's finally come out and will perhaps take a little while to permeate through the UFO field that Oberg has a long history of involvement in one way or another with classified information about UFOs.
I mentioned further in my book that Omni magazine, which is now out of business, but in the late 70s, they started a column on UFOs, and the first contributor was James Oberg. It's an excellent propaganda piece, in my opinion, if you look what he wrote in the, I think it was December of 1978 issue of Omni magazine. It's probably still available at libraries and so on. But he was trying to present an even-handed look at UFOs and suggesting that there were any number of organizations such as MUFON that people could contact. He also touted PSYCOP, and without acknowledging any affiliation with them, as I recall from the article. In any case, if you read very carefully, word for word, what he's saying, it's a very carefully crafted put-down of UFOs, even though at first reading it seems to be fairly even-handed. Well, in the very next issue, there were two letters, one from a Robert Burrow and the other was from Terry Hansen, the same gentleman we've been talking about. Robert Burrow said, come on, Omni, if you're going to publish James Oberg's critique on UFOs as scientific literature, your readers should be aware that he is an Air Force officer in good standing, something that Oberg had not admitted or acknowledged at all in the first article. Now, my dad was career Air Force, and he was very proud of his military service. If he were offered a shot at being published in a national magazine, you can bet he would have used his rank and talked about his Air Force affiliation, which he was very proud of. For whatever reason, Oberg, when debunking UFOs, didn't want to acknowledge that. And in fact, it was not brought to Omni's readers' attention until the next issue when Robert Burrow mentioned the fact that that was the case. Terry Hansen also wrote a scathing critique of what Oberg had to say. So again, you've got this interesting pattern where persons connected with PSYCOP, now CSI, James Oberg and Kendrick Frazier, seem to be shy about acknowledging their either military or their nuclear weapons-related professions when they're at the same time debunking UFOs and saying it's nonsense and that there's no UFOs, no UFO cover-up. In my opinion, those people, if they're going to have that position and present it in widely circulated literature, they need to at least let people know where they're coming from, where their bread is buttered, and how they make their living. So that, I think, is a valid criticism.
It seems to me that the Larry King Show has just about run out of reasonable, in quotes, skeptics, doesn't appear to have any more sensible people left.
Well, there's some behind-the-scenes chatter about that, actually. I first have to say that when Larry King contacted me, his producer, about being on the program, when I agreed to go on, they gave me free hand in terms of selecting two or three other personnel to present my case. And in fact, I was allowed to pick Robert Salas, Robert Jameson, who was a missile targeting officer at Malmstrom, and then Bob Jacobs. I called up each and every one of them and said, let's go on Larry King and present our case. And they let me do that completely, so I have to give them credit for that. At the same time, I think their producers believe they need to have what they call, quote, balance, and so they have to have somebody on the other side of the issue. But their job is to present TV entertainment. They don't have, their producers, their staff doesn't have the time to check out the backgrounds of people, either pro or anti-UFO, to see what their credentials are, what their credibility is. So they just accept the fact that PsyCop slash CSI presents itself as rational and scientific, and so they go with that, and they think they're putting on somebody who has credentials to speak about UFOs to be skeptical of them. And so the result of that situation is they have people like Bill Nye, who just made a fool of himself, in my opinion, made factual error after factual error after factual error when trying to present the debunker's case on UFOs. So after the program, Bob Salas and I wrote emails to some of the producers there saying, look, there are legitimate skeptics who have some credentials. Dr. Bernard Haish, for example. Anyone not familiar with Dr. Haish, his website is ufoskeptic.org. He is what a UFO skeptic should be. Very knowledgeable, very objective in terms of his critique or criticisms about what UFO proponents say and so on. So I've been urging the King producers, if they have me back on, to have someone such as Dr. Haish or someone of his caliber on rather than Bill Nye, the science guy.
When I saw him on there, I thought, what on earth are these people doing? They had that idiot McGahey or McGaha or McGahey,
right,
on there who had nothing to offer. And I thought, they can't sink any lower than this. And then, lo and behold, a man whose science programs I liked in the same way that I liked Nova until I saw the hatchet job they did,
right,
on abductees. And I'm wondering, what the hell are they doing? PsyCop lost its mind and respect for itself?
I actually had people write to me after the Larry King show saying, it's clear that Larry King wanted to make a fool out of Bill Nye because it was obvious he didn't know what he was talking about. So I think these persons were suggesting that Larry King's staff was trying to help my cause by bringing on someone who was clearly not qualified to talk about UFOs. I don't think that was what went on. I think it was just, again, the more of the case that they have to produce a show every day. So they're frantically trying to get together guests for a given topic, and then the next day it's a whole new thing all over again. So they don't have time to really research and check the backgrounds of people like Nye to know that he is ill-qualified to speak on the subject. I really think that's what went on instead.
It's much more showbiz than it is factualness, factuality, reality.
Yeah, pretty much. Right now, the U.S. election is just taking everybody's attention, journalists, certainly in the U.S., if not elsewhere. But once that settles down sometime early next year, I'm hoping to get a press conference together at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., which would be exclusively devoted to ex-U.S. Air Force personnel involved in nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents. Bob Salas has already been invited to speak at the National Press Club twice, but it was a part of a larger examination of UFOs, persons in the military and different countries and so on who had one experience or another or knew of a cover-up of one type or another. I think the subject of UFOs and nukes, however, deserves its own spotlight. It's clearly important. If you have persons that the U.S. government charge with nuclear weapons, allow them to operate them or guard weapons of mass destruction, these persons were psychologically evaluated and rigorously checked their backgrounds before they were allowed near the nukes, and you've got nearly 100 of them that I've located, let alone the ones I've never come across, who are now saying that UFOs tampered with our nuclear weapons. That's a story that obviously needs to be told, not only nationally, but internationally. So I'm hoping at some point to get together a press conference and be sponsored by the National Press Club, where Bob Salas and Bob Jacobs and perhaps a dozen or even two dozens of these credible persons can come forward and tell their stories and let the world in on the big secret.
Is there anything else that we need to cover up before we wrap it up, Robert?
I would simply ask persons who are interested in this topic to go to my website, ufohastings.com. There are articles available there that I think are worth your attention about my work. One of them called UFO sightings at ICBM sites and nuclear weapons storage areas is about 20-some pages of testimony from some of my sources. There's also a way to purchase my book, if you're so inclined, which has nearly 600 pages of information devoted to all of these topics that we've been discussing. I think this is an intriguing story. I think one of the reasons the U.S. government has been so reluctant to go public with their knowledge of UFOs has to do with the fact that they're quite aware now, for decades, UFOs have been monitoring and occasionally interfering with our nuclear weapon. That's a story they obviously do not want the public to be aware of, but it's been going on. I think it should be brought out into the light of day.
UFOs and Nukes, Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapon Sites. You can order the book at Robert Hastings' website, ufohastings.com. And the articles will be linked in this program's listing. Robert Hastings, thank you, sir. Thank you for your work. I really look forward to hearing how the Washington conference happens.
Well, hopefully it will materialize. As I said, I'm trying to bide my time until the political brouhaha settles down a bit. So we'll see.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. You don't want to compete with the likes of Sarah Palin. Thank you again, Robert.
My pleasure.
Look forward to talking to you again. Thank you. As I said in the intro to Robert Hastings, he has been on this program before, and that is well worth listening to. So avail yourself of your access to the archives of Strange Days Indeed. Go grab it, download it, and listen. You'll also find on the page there, in case you hadn't noticed, and I'm sure you had, links to the websites of people who have been on this program, including Stuart Miller and Robert Hastings. Thank you for your subscription and for your interest. We'll talk to you next time, Maria.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.